Paralyzing pain lanced into the back of Kane's neck, flooding and overwhelming the nerve endings throughout his entire body. He tried to whirl, to bring up his blaster. Instead, he shambled clumsily, dimly aware he was falling to one side.
Ah, I see one of you took the bait.
Kane caught a fragmented glimpse of Captain Ivornich's slender, compact figure. She smiled at him over the black, sparking object in her right hand. Then he was floating in a comfortable, sepia sea of unconsciousness. With a shocking suddenness, Kane awoke. It was as if a great hand snatched him up by the scruff of the neck and flung him into a cold and miserable reality. He felt something hard against his back and a stiffness in his neck. For an instant, that felt as long as an eternity, he fought against a surge of panic. When it passed, he cracked his eyelids and saw his lap. Then he opened his eyes and forced them to focus on his surroundings. He was in a small, square metal room with flat gray walls. The room was evenly, almost intimately lit from some invisible source. He saw no doors or windows, and there seemed to be no ceiling. In front of him stood a small desk. Piled atop it was his coat, sweater, combat harness, and holstered sin-eater. He looked down at himself. He had been stripped except for his pants. Naked to the waist, he was seated in a high-backed wooden chair, his wrists tightly bound to the arms by leather cuffs. Long wafers of metal ran along the wood beneath his arms. His bare back pressed against a wider metal plate. It didn't feel uncomfortably cold, so he figured he had been sitting in the chair long enough for his body heat to warm the metal. Carefully, he leaned to the right, looking down. The square chair legs were bolted solidly to the floor. He gathered his muscles, straining them against the cuffs, testing their strength. A wave of icy agony coursed through him, streaking up his arms, over and across his back. Slowly, the wave receded, easing away.
How do you like our attitude adjuster, outsider?
Effective. It'll work the kinks out of your back, for sure.
He looked up at Captain Ivornich as she walked around the chair and stood in front of the desk, leaning one hip casually against a corner. In her right hand, she held a small box molded from metal. Two buttons, one green, one red, studded its surface. Clipped to the belt around her waist was a black plastic instrument. Two metal prongs protruded from one end. Kane recognized it as a stun gun, which delivered an incapacitating electric shock.
I suppose I should thank you for not shooting me.
Really? I wouldn't if I were you.
Kane's muscles twisted a brief spasm.
Do you still wish to thank me?
Kane refused to respond.
Good. Save your breath. You have a lot of screaming yet to do. You will tell me two things. How much classified information you know about the project and how you know.
Know about what?
Colonel Sverdlovsk and District 12, for starters.
I don't know the colonel at all.
Give me some credit. I trapped you like a rabbit in a snare. I fed you a story about the colonel arriving this morning, when in actuality the call I received was to apprise me that he would be late in returning. It seems he had a bit of transportation trouble in Mongolia. His vehicle went missing.
That's a shame.
You were under surveillance almost to the moment of your apprehension. By the way, your companion received a very poor price for the horse.
She figured as much.
Turning slightly, Ivornich lifted the holstered sin-eater.
Unusual design. It appears to be a customized reframed Spectre autoblaster, dating back to the late 1980s. Is it a standard sidearm for those in your profession?
Profession?
American spy. Or insurgent. I grant you, we know very little of the conditions in America since the nuclear war.
Then we're even.
By no means. I suspect you and your companions did not come here simply to look around. How did you get here anyway?
You wouldn't believe me.
Probably not. I do believe you were sent here from one of the so-called baronies to get information. Which one?
Which one what? Which barony?
Yes.
I'm what you might call an independent contractor.
What does that mean?
Can you give me an idea of where I might be? Or is that classified too?
You are in the Territorial Police Substation on Previnsk Street, under the jurisdiction of District 2.
What is District 2?
Our national government consists of four major superstructures or districts. Each of these have clearly delineated responsibilities. Labor, security, mutuality, politics. A general policy-making body is made up of executives from all the districts. Don't you have something similar in your baronies?
Similar. We call them divisions.
A typically American militaristic mindset.
Look who's talking, Captain.
Look who... Ah, I see. You meant that as a joke, didn't you? Glad to see it. A sense of humor is an absolute necessity in situations like these.
It's gotten me into trouble before.
I don't doubt it.
Her thumb tapped the red button. The jolt of electricity surging through the arms and back of the chair was very brief, but he winced just the same.
The current can be increased to become quite painful, even lethal.
I figured that out myself.
In your country, this would no doubt be considered a vile, inhuman torture, wouldn't it?
Actually, no. In my country, this little attitude adjuster of yours would be laughed at because it's so ineffectual and merciful.
Really? According to the American history I was taught, criminals were treated very leniently, coddled even.
Not anymore. Not for a very, very long time. Of course, almost everyone in my country is now treated like a criminal, and not very leniently either.
Including yourself?
Especially myself.
What was your crime?
I asked all the right questions.
Did you receive answers?
Oh, yes.
I too seek answers, outsider.
Then ask the right fucking questions, Captain.
I did not gain the appointment of territorial commander because I am a woman and therefore soft. The Council invested 8 years of training and education in me to manufacture a tool. The tool is of the hardest forged steel. You cannot match your steel against mine.
I don't want to, Captain. Maybe we can agree to an information exchange. Tell me where my friends are.
You are in no position to ask for anything.
Just because I'm an American does not make me an enemy. The war is long over. There's no reason to continue hostilities that burned themselves out nearly 200 years ago.
Idiot. I don't give a damn about old political differences or building new bridges of understanding between our respective nations.
Then what do you give a damn about?
A rise to power. A rise which does not need to be diverted by factors such as yourself and your friends. You are a mystery, and I hate mysteries. They tend to give me headaches, and I feel a very severe one coming on.
I don't care much for mysteries myself, but I'm here to solve one.
Which is?
The Black City. The Sacred Flame. The Tushegun.
Nonsense words.
The Archon Directorate.
He saw by the sudden change of expression on her smooth face, he had said the wrong thing.
You've wasted enough of my time. If you will not provide me with straight answers, I will not provide you with any more of it.
Though her tone was heavy with menace, Kane detected an undernote of warning in her eyes and voice.
Do those two words mean something to you?
No.
What about one of them, then? Like Archon?
Like a bolt of lightning, pain ripped through Kane's nervous system. His nerves seemed to catch fire, electric with agony. He writhed and convulsed. Kane was bathed in sweat. Ivornich leaned forward until their faces were only inches apart.
I don't enjoy this. I am certain you do not either. So speak no more nonsense to me. Do you understand?
Yeah.
Do you have a name?
Kane.
Kane? Just that one name?
Just Kane. My family name.
No first name?
If I do have one, I don't know it. And you, Captain, do you have a first name?
Lenya. However, I do not use it much anymore.
You prefer, Captain?
I do. I've risen fast and far in the internal security network. So many of my superiors, my peers, perished in the last two revolutions. The Council had no choice but to promote me. I'm still rising, still going far. Survival and success, that's how to get ahead.
I appreciate the advice. Maybe it'll help me survive the revolutions brewing in my country.
Ah, tell me about them.
They haven't happened yet.
Is that why you are in my country? To learn from the experts? You could not have come to a better place. History has always conspired to tear Russia apart through internal strife, throughout all the great ages of change.
Or Russia conspired against history.
You speak of the war, the Holocaust that should not have happened.
Yes, the new cost, the Skydark.
You believe my country started it?
I don't know. That's what I thought. I believed it most of my life. Now I'm no longer sure. I'm undergoing something of a revolution myself. A revolution of the mind.
Explain.
I don't know if I can. How long does it take for the mind to finally realize it has been conditioned, tricked, deceived, and betrayed? How long does it take to comprehend independence, freedom, responsibility?
You intrigue me, Cain. Perhaps you are a spy, perhaps not. Why should the Americans now make such an effort to enter Russia, take such a risk?
I don't represent a government, Lenya.
Then what is your mission?
That's not the right question.
Captain Lenya Ivornich's violet eyes went cold. She stared hard at him, lifting the metal box in her hand so he could see it.
If you are a spy, you will die. If you are not, there might be a difference in your sentence.
I am what I am, Captain.
Her thumb brushed the red button. Cain tensed, keeping his eyes on her face. Then she dropped the control box to the desktop and stood up, spine stiffening, shoulders squared. Reaching out, she stroked his cheek, a quick, perfunctory caress.
Cooperate with me, Cain.
With her left hand, she made a sharp, beckoning wave. Cain saw a portion of the gray wall open as if by itself. Two uniformed SecMen stepped through. He realized the door was apparently operated from the outside, which meant that somewhere behind the walls was either a one-way window or an observation chamber, so everything that had been said or done was witnessed or recorded. Ivornich pointed to Cain.
Take him out back and shoot him.
One guard swiftly loosened the leather cuffs around Cain's wrists, while the other covered him with a stubby black Makarov hand blaster. He was hauled to his feet, arms wrenched behind his back, and steel handcuffs snapped around his wrists. The captain turned her back, not looking at him as he was hustled out of the room. In a dim stone corridor outside the gray interrogation room, the guards pushed Cain before them to the right along the dank passageway. They walked down a steep flight of steps, the clammy cold radiating from the stone and seeming to penetrate to Cain's bones. The stairs ended in another dark corridor. It turned to the left, then pitched downward. Cain felt that he was descending to the bowels of Mother Russia herself, and he wondered how the route he was marching could possibly fit the definition of out back. He was pulled to a stop at a rust-streaked iron door. The guard shoved him into a small, musty, murky room. It was all square blocks of grim gray stone. He prepared himself to receive a kick or a kidney punch, but neither came. Dim light filtered down from a barred window high overhead, casting most of the cell into deep shadow. A tall, slender man stepped out from a wedge of darkness beside the door. He wore a maroon tunic, khaki jodhpurs, and high black boots. His curly blonde hair was turning ivory at the temples. His brown eyes were surrounded by crinkles, and deep lines creased the weather-beaten skin on either side of his sharp nose. He looked at Cain intently.
I am Colonel Pyotr Svedlovsk. No one can see or hear us in this room. Now, tell me who you really are and why you are here.
A little of the pre-dawn snowfall had settled on the field adjacent to the old factory complex. Between the railroad tracks and the gloomy facades of the warehouses, patches of snow turned to brown slush as the temperature rose. Grant, prone in the muck 50 yards away from the number 12 warehouse, awaited Bridget's next signal. He was as motionless as a fallen obsidian statue, not even breathing deeply. Though he lay in a shallow channel beside a length of track, he did nothing to betray his position to the pair of internal security network men patrolling the perimeter around the complex. Upon hearing the first crackle of blaster fire, he had gone to ground and waited. And waited. He had received Kane's transcom message, and he assumed Bridget had as well. From his position, he watched as several SEC officers carted Kane's limp body out of the warehouse and dumped him in the back of the canvas-covered truck. They were obviously obeying the orders of a black-haired woman bundled up in a woolen coat. Grant waited for other officers to lug Bridget out, but instead, a wounded man was helped into the truck. The woman climbed into the cab behind the wheel and drove away, leaving four men and a jeep behind. He was puzzled and irritated. He hadn't given in to the urge to call Bridget, hoping she was still hidden somewhere inside the cavernous warehouse. He had been on the verge of rising and investigating when his transcom circuit opened and he heard a very faint nonverbal signal. Bridget tapped out a code on the transceiver of her own comm unit, evidently fearing to speak. She repeated the tapped-out message and closed the frequency. She had told Grant not to re-enter the warehouse. She was hidden in the rafters. When she was in no danger of being overheard, she would contact him again. So Grant had waited, for over an hour, watching the SEC men come in and out of the open double doors of the warehouse. They stood in front of it now, smoking hand-rolled cigarettes. The officers cocked their heads toward the train locomotive, moving in reverse past him. It backed up toward a single boxcar. Grant tried very hard to look like a bump in the ground from his hiding place about 100 yards away. The men in the engine cab paid no attention to anything but what lay behind them. Carefully, he turned his head as the engine crawled toward the boxcar. A squat-bodied man jumped out of the cab and approached the coupling of the car, not looking in any other direction. At that moment, Grant's transcom circuit opened with a faint crackle.
Grant, do you copy?
With a thumb and forefinger of his right hand, Grant drew out the pin mic from his coat's lapel.
I copy. You safe?
For the moment. The officers are gone. I think they've given up.
Grant gazed toward the warehouse. Two of the SEC men pulled the double door shut, locking it with a chain and padlock.
They have.
They've got Kane. Captain Ivornich was with them.
I saw. They dumped him in a wagon and drove off.
To where?
I don't know.
Was he alive?
Believe so. He was unconscious, though.
Are you able to reach the warehouse?
Maybe. Might take me a little while. I'll have to go the long way around.
All right. I'll go to the window where we entered. When you're well on your way, signal me and I'll meet you around back.
Grant closed the circuit, releasing the pin mic, allowing the tiny spring and pulley sewn inside his coat to retract it into the lapel. Carefully, he belly crawled along the channel parallel to the warehouse, continuing to sneak looks both at the SEC officers and the man attaching the boxcar to the locomotive. None of them so much as glanced in his direction. When he reached a point where he was facing the building's east wall and out of sight of the guards in the front, he heaved himself to his feet and skulked toward the far corner. He crossed the 50 yards with a long, ground-eating stride, and he almost made it. A uniformed man stepped from around the rear wall. He didn't see Grant immediately, but when he did, he came to a clumsy halt, his feet skidding in the slippery slush. He tried to unlimber his Kalashnikov rifle, but the strap fouled in the collar of his coat and he lost his balance. Flailing his arms, he went down like an empty gunny sack. He scrambled to his hands and knees, still struggling with his blaster's shoulder strap. Grant rushed forward, leaped into the air, and landed on the astonished officer's back. His left hand cupped the man's chin while his right forearm came across the windpipe and hauled back. The rifle slipped off the officer's arm and hit the ground. Grant put all of his upper body strength into a backward wrench. He dropped the man face first into the muck and looked around to make sure no one had witnessed the brief struggle. Gathering a fistful of coat in one hand, he dragged the corpse along the wall and around the corner. The man had evidently decided to make a final perimeter patrol, and his comrades would miss him very soon. He rolled the body into a stand of weeds, kicked enough muck over it to hide the human outline, and carrying the Kalashnikov under an arm, he crept quickly to the west corner of the warehouse. The way was clear. He activated his transcom unit.
Now.
Almost immediately, he saw Bridget's booted feet come through the open window, followed an instant later by the rest of her. She had lost her fur hat somewhere in the warehouse, and her heavy mounds of hair tumbled freely about her shoulders. Staying close to the wall, she ran soundlessly toward him, looking back only once. When she was around the corner, she acknowledged the rifle in Grant's hands with a nod.
Did you chill the man who had that?
What do you think? Kane could be just as dead by now, so you'd better find it in your heart not to pass judgment.
We have to find him.
How? The mission is compromised, and what little cover story we had is blown to hell. The only way to find him is to give ourselves up and hope we'll be taken to the same place he is.
They've probably taken him to the nearest militia station.
Probably. First things first, though. We've got to find a way out of this dump.
Grant and Bridget's eyes met. Quickly, they moved along the rear wall to the corner. The iron wheels of the engine turned slowly on the track, finding traction as it pulled the freight car behind it. A puff of white vapor floated from the smokestack.
We'll have to run for it. Run and not look back. We've got to reach that boxcar before it's in view of the guards around front.
I'm a good runner, you know that.
Yeah, I do.
but you tend to get distracted easy. If you hear me shooting, don't look around, don't stop, don't even slow down. Understood?
Understood.
Go.
They lunged from the cover of the warehouse wall, racing across the open ground toward the train. Bridget was faster, and she obviously held back so as not to outdistance Grant. He was a little annoyed, but appreciative of her consideration. Legs pumping, they jumped across the shallow channel and sprinted alongside the tracks. The stock of the Kalashnikov bumped painfully against Grant's upper thigh. The freight car went past them. They crossed the tracks, leaping nimbly over the cross ties to get on the far side of it, in order to be blocked from the officer's view. The sliding door was open. Grant and Bridget sprang for it, snatching handholds and wriggling their bodies inside. The car had been used to haul cattle in the recent past. The wood plank walls exuded the stench of animals, and there were piles of fairly fresh manure on the floor.
Now what?
Grant peered between the slats of the freight car's wall. The warehouse complex and the collection of SEC officers slowly receded.
Let's get to the locomotive and question the engineer. We'll force him to take us as close as he can to the security network station.
That'll mean climbing around on the outside of the train.
You're a fine runner. Time to find out just how agile you are, too.
Let's get to it!
As the train rolled at a moderate 20 miles per hour through the rail yard, Grant and Bridget eased themselves out onto the exterior of the swaying car. The spaces between the horizontal sections and the sidewall provided them with secure foot and handholds. On the roof of the freight car, they walked spraddle-legged and stumbling, ducking their heads beneath the spark-shot layer of vapor wafting back from the smokestack. Reaching the lip of the car, they lay flat and looked down over the coal tender into the open cab of the locomotive. There were only two men, both in dirty overalls, one the engineer and the other the fireman, who shoveled coal into the gaping maw of the firebox. Bridget and Grant waited until the man scooped up a shovelful and turned away before they moved. Grant went first, swinging himself over and down, landing atop the pile of coal, starting a miniature avalanche. The locomotive made too much noise for the sound of his landing to be heard. Bridget slid down next and clambered over the black lumps of fuel into the exposed rear section of the cab. At that moment, the coal shoveler turned away from the firebox. Bridget pulled out her Mauser.
Freeze!
The engineer didn't hear the command, but the fireman, a stockily built young man with blunt features, threw the shovel at her. Bridget squeezed the trigger of her hand blaster as soon as the shovel flew from his hands. The shovel flew past its mark, but the .32 caliber bullet took the fireman in the meat of his right shoulder, spinning him against the engineer. He fell down on the sooty floor plate, writhing. The engineer, a heavyset man, was about 50 with a silvery beard. He kept his hand on the throttle even as he twisted himself around, his dirty face stamped with shock and fright.
Get out of the cab, now!
The fireman sat down unhappily atop the coal in the tender, hand clapped over his shoulder. Blood seeped slowly between his grimy fingers. Grant inspected the wound, saw it wasn't serious, and covered the man with the Kalashnikov. Standing beside the engineer, Bridget placed the bore of the Mauser only a few inches from his right ear.
Where is the nearest internal security network station?
Pravinsk Street.
How close can you get us to it?
The rail runs over the street, but this is a direct route. There are no stops.
We'll make one. Do what you have to do to get us there, but play us false and you will die.
I understand.
The engineer regarded her bleakly for a second, nodded in resignation, and turned a valve wheel. The locomotive continued to chug along, but couldn't travel very fast through the rail yard. The track wasn't designed for rapid traffic, and there were three points to be switched over. The linemen in the yard moved lazily to change them. The train finally worked its way past the main terminus and joined an artery wending its way through the city proper.
Hey, do we need this fireman, slagger?
Bridget cast the young man a quick look and gestured with her blaster.
You, jump out! We're not going fast enough for you to be hurt.
Reluctantly, hands still over the bleeding hole in his shoulder, the fireman rose and climbed down the steps of the cab. He hesitated, then leaped off into the weeds. The train continued to gain speed. Buildings and hovels and ruins flitted past.
How far now?
2 kilometers, more or less. We must pass a checkpoint.
Will you be obliged to stop?
The engineer nibbled at his lower lip and didn't respond. Bridget dug the barrel of the Mauser into his ear.
Answer me!
No! It is a checkpoint for passenger trains, not freight!
The locomotive chugged its way deeper into a metropolitan area. They seemed to be traveling infuriatingly slowly, but their speed was right at the legal limit. To exceed it would draw attention. Leaning to the right to look out the open cab window, the engineer looked frightened.
They've closed the checkpoint!
Bridget translated for Grant, and he climbed down from the coal pile to take a look ahead. A barrier of wood painted in red and yellow stripes bisected the tracks. At least a dozen armed SEC officers stood on either side of the rails.
They're on to us. How?
A fireman, probably.
Ow!
As the engineer reached for the brake lever, she swatted his hand with her blaster.
We must slow down. It is the law.
Ram it. Increase our speed.
But it is not permitted.
Ram it!
The engineer twisted the throttle wheel, feeding more heat to the boilers. The locomotive's cowcatcher drove into the striped barrier, sending fragments of wood and splinters spraying in every direction. The train rumbled past, but they heard no blaster fire. Far from being relieved, Grant was at first confused, then worried.
They didn't shoot at us. That means they've got an ace on the line waiting for us.
You! How soon to Provinsk Street?
Very soon. A minute.
Bridget cast a quick look toward Grant. He was staring at the transceiver tab on his lapel in surprise. He met her gaze.
I'm getting a signal.
Grant pulled out the pin mic, automatically engaging the circuit.
Grant? Grant?
Where are you?
About a quarter of a mile ahead of you, on the tracks.
Grant poked his head over the side. In the distance, he made out a dark shape spanning the width of the rails.
You've got to stop. They brought up heavy artillery to blow the train to scrap metal if you don't.
What happens when we stop? Are we under arrest, scheduled for immediate execution, or what?
Or what? I can't explain now, but you won't be harmed. Prisoners.
A dozen possibilities, a dozen scenarios whirled through Grant's head in a fraction of an instant. But if Kane was in his right mind, unaffected by drugs or other influences, he would allow himself to be roasted to death before playing the Judas. Judging by his voice, he sounded clear-headed enough.
You want me to believe the Russians want to be our friends?
No, not friends, but not enemies either. At least not now.
The blocky shape straddling the railroad tracks acquired a definite and identifiable outline as the locomotive rolled nearer. It was a light field cannon resting on big rubber tires. The 10-foot-long barrel was aimed directly at the front of the engine. Grant figured the artillery piece fired armor-piercing, high-velocity rounds and could certainly do what Kane said it could. He counted at least 20 SEC officers standing on both sides of the tracks.
Acknowledge.
Acknowledged. We'll comply.
Bridget had figured out the gist of the conversation. She hazarded a quick look out of the cab window.
We have no choice. Engineer, lay off the steam and start braking.
Oh, thank
you! Grant left the rifle in the coal tender, and he and Bridget stepped down on the left side of the locomotive, fingers laced at the backs of their necks. Grant glared at the dozen blaster bores pointed at him. Kane stepped forward, wearing his black coat, looking damnably calm and fresh. Captain Lenya Ivornich walked beside him, one arm through his. Both of them smiled at Bridget and Grant, but they didn't smile back.
Put your hands down. You look like you're doing calisthenics.
Now what? Torture or jail or both?
A quartet of officers parted, moving aside, allowing the lean figure of Colonel Sverdlovsk to push his way forward.
Actually, I thought we all might have an early supper. Sure, you've worked up quite the appetite by now, running all over outer Moscow with your silly American knees bent.
Sverdlovsk bestowed upon Bridget a wide, welcoming smile, took her gloved hand in his, and pressed his lips to it.
And you, Baptiste, are even lovelier than I imagined. I look forward to renewing our friendship.
The low-ceilinged room was lit by flare-mouthed kerosene lanterns. Heavy purple drapes masked the windows, admitting no light in or out. The dining room was big, scattered with nearly two dozen cheesecloth-covered tables. A pleasant wood fire blazed in the hearth. A gramophone, obviously a reproduction of the machine that had been popular in an earlier century, played an old-time folk tune. The place was an anachronism. Ivornich had claimed it was an accurate copy of the type of eateries favored by the social elite during the days of Tsar Nicholas. He also implied that they'd be safer there than in official custody. The restaurant was completely empty except for Ivornich, Kane, Bridget, Grant, and Sverdlovsk. Only the three strangers had been served food, bowls of a rich, meaty stew Sverdlovsk had prepared and called beef stroganoff. He didn't eat. He drank from a bottle of vodka and strutted back and forth around the room. He was a happy man. They tried to ignore him and appear unconcerned, even though all three of them had been completely disarmed. Even Grant and Kane's Kevlar weave coats were confiscated.
It is so funny. You don't realize how funny it really is.
Grant scowled as he stared, then turned to Kane seated next to him.
It does my heart good to see a thoroughly tickled man.
Kane pushed his empty bowl away and poured a tumbler full of vodka from the decanter on the table. He tasted it, made a face, then downed the contents of the glass in one gulp. He turned to the table where Lenya Ivornich sat nursing a goblet of wine.
Let us in on the joke, why don't you?
Ivornich shook her head, glancing at Sverdlovsk in irritation. The colonel kept striding back and forth, swinging the bottle in one hand like a dinner bell. For the past 45 minutes, he had brushed off all of their questions and imbibed the liquor, immensely relishing its effects. Crossing the room to Ivornich, he draped an arm about her slim shoulders and pointed to the three Americans, closing one eye as if he were sighting down the barrel of a gun.
See them, Lenya. Did you ever dream that the solution to our problem would drop into our laps, borne across the sea by the wind of the wolf?
Not at all.
Kane, what in God's name did you tell them?
Damn little. I thought I was being a good, tight-lipped, tight-assed mag. They tortured me some.
Tortured you?
Persuasion techniques that wouldn't force a pit slagjacker to tell you the time of day. I mentioned the Archon Directorate, told Sverdlovsk a bit about where we're from, and he got all happy.
Sverdlovsk danced clumsily over to their table, pouring vodka from his bottle into their glasses. He pulled up a chair and dropped into it.
Drink, my comrades, and I'll tell you a funny story. You came here to find out what was going on in the Black Gobi with warlords and armies.
There doesn't seem to be any point in denying it.
That's where the joke comes in. You can give me the final pieces I need to complete the puzzle and win the prize.
If you don't mind, we'd like to hear the punchline of this fucking hilarious joke so we can all laugh along with you.
Why not? Captain Ivornich and myself are executives of District 12.
She told me there were only four districts in your government.
District 12 does not officially exist. Even mention of it to those who are not themselves members is a capital offense.
What's the function of the 12th district?
To find pre-dog secrets, pre-dog tech. To keep pre-dog secrets and pre-dog tech. Specifically, to secure any and everything related to the totality concept researches, like the gateway units. I'm sure you have something similar to District 12 in your baronies, else you would not be here enjoying my company. There is a phenomenon occurring in the Black Gobi, in the city of Karokoto. As I'm sure you've guessed, the phenomenon is not a natural one.
You're right, we guessed it. Do you have any ideas or speculations on the nature of the phenomenon?
Oh, I do indeed. And I did not rely on my judgment alone, sound though it is. But I digress. A bad habit of mine when I'm off duty.
Sverdlovsk leaned forward and slammed the base of the liquor bottle atop the table.
I'll begin at the beginning. I will ask you to listen without interrupting.
Despite the man's ebullient mood, all three outlanders noticed that Sverdlovsk's raw-boned face bore lines of strain, great and immediate. Kane shot a sideways glance at Lenya Ivornich and saw the same thing swimming in her violet eyes. Sverdlovsk leaned back in his chair.
My country's present form of government is less than 2 years old, only the latest incarnation of several versions that were conceived, implemented, and then discarded since Skydark. What we have now is a corrupted synthesis of social democracy, Marxism, and friendly fascism. This version will end soon, too, either by another revolution or by collapsing beneath the weight of its own bureaucracy. It is inevitable. And that inevitability was one reason District 12 was created some two decades ago. Simply to ensure that some sort of covert continuity bridges successive governments. It is quite maddening, this unceasing turmoil.
What he's trying to find the English word for is to describe how we have lived in fear of a return of the anarchy of Skydark, and how desperate we are to prevent it by any means necessary.
Thank you. I'm always pleased to have words I did not mean put into my mouth.
Ivornich flushed at the sarcasm, either from anger or embarrassment, and Sverdlovsk turned back to his captive audience.
Actually, what she said is fairly accurate as to our basic motivations. Fear. At any rate, when I was assigned District 12 duties several years ago, my main function was to pore over old intelligence files in search of hard data and references to the Totality Concept projects. Very few pre-doc records still existed, but I gleaned sufficient information to understand that although the fundamental foundation for the concept's researchers were primarily American, bits and pieces of it were shared with Russia. As I understand it, one of your pre-doc presidents publicly acknowledged his intent to share the SDI technology with my country.
SDI?
Strategic Defense Initiative. It was colloquially known as the Star Wars program. It was about the only aspect of the Totality Concept projects that the general public ever heard anything about. The SDI program was part of Mission Snowbird.
Precisely. And did I indicate that you were not to interrupt? In any event, the report filed by Major Commissar Zimyanin regarding the gateway unit he discovered beneath the Peredelenko Dacha was my starting point. Obviously, it is still functional, or you three would not be here. Poor Zimyanin. He secured the place as best he could in those wild old days, and his reward was to be shipped off to oversee a slave labor camp in the Yukon. He knew too much to keep around, I imagine.
Rising from his chair, Sverdlovsk paced over to the hearth, warming his hands near the dancing flames. Kane glanced again at Lenya Ivornich. She met his gaze unblinkingly. The eyes in her marble-smooth face were flint-hard and flint-cold.
So many wonders, so many scientific marvels created by men. And in the end, none of it mattered. Through my investigations, I learned other things. I came across mysterious references to the origin of the Totality Concept technologies. It was something the Americans called the Archon Directive. I didn't understand what it meant. Who were the Archons? What was their directive? What did it have to do with the Totality Concept? Very strange. The Archon Directive. Inasmuch as I had no idea of his meaning, I could not pursue it, given the fragmentary nature of the intel I was working with. Later, I found that another gateway unit existed within China's former sphere of influence, out in the southwestern Gobi. In order to find the installation, I saw to it that an old pre-dark military base in Mongolia was reactivated. I went there and enlisted the aid of the nomadic tribesmen, specifically the clan ruled by Boro Orolak. I promised them food, medicines, weapons, if they would search the Black Gobi for anything unusual. After a few months, Boro's search paid off. He found the underground gateway installation, as did you, Baptiste. You and your companions knew it was already there, just like you knew about the one in Peredelenko. However, I could not enter the installation. The sect door defied all my attempts to breach it. Just as well, I suppose. I am an old-fashioned fellow, and the very notion of having my essence transmitted to a distant point like a radio wave makes me incontinent.
Forgive yet another interruption, but I never got around to thanking you for allowing me to escape. I am grateful.
Interruption forgiven. However, by the time I finish my tale, you may feel that your gratitude is not only premature, but misplaced.
That sounds like a threat, Colonel.
Really? I did not mean it to sound so. Miscommunication, perhaps. My English is not perfect.
Sverdlovsk rejoined them at the table.
Ah. I am relaxed, and perhaps a little drunk. My belly is full of hot vodka, and my head swirls with ideas. Where was I? Oh, yes. During the search for the gateway, Boro's youngest son came across the ruins of Karo Koto. The son's name is, or was, Shakir. He explored the place, since it loomed large in Mongolian legend. He discovered an underground vault beneath the ruins. When the discovery was reported back to me, I paid the tribe to begin excavations. I hoped the vault was yet another Totality Concept installation, or at the very least held relics of historical value. I had read of Kozlov's explorations, of course, so I provided the necessary digging equipment and left the Mongols to do their work. I had returned to Russia. Many months passed. Progress reports became sporadic. Then they finally ceased altogether. I returned to Mongolia and found much had changed in my absence. Boro Orolak had abdicated his position. Shakir was now the undisputed chieftain and had assumed the title of the Supreme Chief. Quite the promotion for a 16-year-old boy. He had forged an alliance between several western and northern tribes, and their united objective was to restore Karukoto to its former mythical glory. I was still on friendly terms with Boro, and I sought him out. He had changed from a happy, freedom-loving savage to an embittered drunkard. He told me that his son had bathed in the black flame of Shamos and undergone a terrifying transformation into a creature that was neither half man nor half god, yet the same and not the same. He was very confused on this point. He claimed Shakir was the reincarnation of Karo Bator, Temujin, Amur Sana, and Damben Jansang. He hinted that it was not just a spiritual reincarnation either. It went beyond the metaphysical. Furthermore, Boror accused his son of stealing the souls of his tribesmen, using the dragon ring of Genghis Khan. Oh, crazy Tatar talk, I figured. Superstition. He described a few of the artifacts that had been found in the subterranean chamber, but they were filtered through his own uneducated frame of reference and made no sense to me. I asked him to visit the vault again and take photographs with the camera I would provide, but he refused, saying he would never enter such a devil's workshop again. So I asked him to draw pictures.
Sliding a hand inside his tunic, Sverdlovsk withdrew a paper packet bound with twine. He tossed it onto the table.
Boro executed the drawings from memory. Traditionally, a Mongol's powers of observation and recollection are phenomenal, since they have to rely solely on their memories to find water and game without the benefits of maps or signposts. Look them over. Judge them by content, not by style or technique.
Brigid untied the twine and unfolded several sheets of the coarse-grain wood pulp paper. Each one was covered with pencil sketches. The three of them looked at the first sketch, and Kane felt dread spring into his mind. It was a symbol, a thick-walled triangle bisected by three black vertical lines. The lines somewhat resembled stylized, round-hilted daggers.
According to Boro, that symbol was everywhere inside the vault. Something tells me it strikes a chord in you, Comrade Kane.
Kane didn't acknowledge the comment, either with words or his expression. He examined the second sketch. It looked like a pair of solid black cubes, a smaller one balanced atop the larger. A stick figure representation of a man stood beside it, giving the impression that the two cubes were around 12 feet tall. All three of them recognized that drawing, too. The other drawings depicted jumbles of geometric shapes, ellipses, oblongs, cylinders, cubes, and triangles. Some looked familiar, others were completely indecipherable.
Obviously, what lay beneath Karukoto was far more arcane, more ancient than anything connected to gateway units. I was familiar with the myths surrounding the vault, but when I offered my input, I was not permitted entry. When I learned that a number of tribesmen were suffering from symptoms similar to radiation poisoning, much like members of Kozlov's expedition, I ingratiated myself with Boro's people, providing drugs, medicines, that sort of thing. By now, Shakir had upped the ante of his self-proclaimed divinity and adopted the title of Touche Goon, the Avenging Lama. He took notice of my contributions, and we worked out a bargain. I would see to it that he received the material he needed to restore the power of Karukoto, and Russia would benefit. An alliance of convenience, as in the old days. Have any of you ever seen anything like those drawings before?
Perhaps.
Perhaps. And perhaps you can give me an idea of what they might be.
Perhaps. You've never been in Karukoto?
In the city proper, in an area designated for visitors, but never to the vault. I presume that is where most of the material I supply ends up.
If you have a military base nearby, why haven't you simply taken the place? According to Baptiste, the tribesmen were poorly armed.
Ivornich and Sverdlovsk exchanged swift glances and then dour smiles.
To involve the military would mean apprising our superiors of what is going on in Karukoto. They do not know.
Yet. It is a secret undertaking, the full details known only to Lenya and myself. As District 12 executives, we are above reproach. Our orders are not questioned by our subordinates.
What was it you said? Survival and success? That's how to get ahead?
Exactly. Pyotr and I have no intention of being dispossessed by the next revolution.
Is them marked on your calendars, or what?
It might as well be. Actually, we are a bit overdue. It will probably come in the next year or so. A famine is projected for next winter.
So, Colonel, you and the captain hope to build a power base with whatever lies beneath Karakoto. Once you find out whatever it really is, of course.
I already know one thing, American. I cannot sleep easily at night, knowing that a legion of ignorant barbarians might have in their dirty hands the power to destroy a large portion of the world and poison the rest of it. What is the Archon Directive?
Cain said, Directorate, Pyotr.
Thank you, my dear. Well, Cain, what is it?
The Directorate or the Directive?
Both.
Cain's grin widened, but it was a hard, humorless grin.
The Archon Directive was the pre-Dark commanding body of an ultra-secret agreement between a pan-terrestrial race and segments of several world governments. It was by following the Archon Directive that the totality concept was implemented. The major objective of the Directive was to orchestrate the nuke cost.
Cain reached out and tapped the sheet of paper decorated with the triangle and vertical line sketch.
This was... is... their insignia.
Cain!
The Archon Directorate, separate and distinct from the Directive, now rules what's left of the Earth. All from the shadows, of course. This drawing of the two cubes, we saw something very much like this in an underground complex in Dulce, New Mexico. We can't be certain, but it's probably an energy generator. The rest of the stuff, hell, it's anybody's guess. Flying saucers, radio gear, plumbing fixtures, who knows?
Cain.
Cain what? Who gives a shit who knows about it? Why shouldn't we let the Colonel and the Captain in on this? They should have an idea of what their ambitions have gotten them tangled up with.
Pan-terrestrial race? Aliens?
Aliens, yeah, but not necessarily from outer space. Maybe originally, but they've been here a very, very long time. They think they have the more legitimate claim on Earth, since they supposedly raised us up from the ape. Oh, I almost forgot. Their primary goal is to hybridize the human race, make the future generations half-breeds, so to speak. That's the destiny they've plotted for us.
Sverdlovsk stood up so suddenly, so violently, his chair fell over backward. Eyes wild, his lips worked, but no sound came out from between them. He stabbed a shaking finger toward the calm Cain.
Well, Colonel, I think I've given you the real punchline to your private joke.
Sverdlovsk gripped the sides of his head and raised his face to the low ceiling.
Yes! Yes, yes, yes!
He capered around in a small circle, performing a dervish dance of delight.
That is the answer! It has to be! Alien technology!
Sverdlovsk turned on Cain, spreading his arms in an eloquent gesture as though inviting an embrace.
Cain, my ugly American comrade! The final piece of the puzzle! How can I ever thank you?
You believe me?
Why shouldn't I? Russia certainly had its share of encounters with these Archons of yours in the past. Have you ever heard of Tunguska? No matter. So the Archons did it, did they?
Did what?
Blew it up! The world!
Not exactly. They put the wheels in motion, but we still don't know what they actually did.
For nearly 200 years, my people have been taught that the charge that we began the Holocaust was simply propaganda. Most of us suspected otherwise, and it was a terrible psychological burden. And now to find out that it really was propaganda, well, I for one am beside myself with joy.
There's more to the story than that. As usual, Cain simplified everything to the point of imbecility.
There is always more to every story, my lovely young woman, particularly the one in the Black Gobi.
Okay, so now you know. How does that help you in your little endeavor out in Mongolia?
You misspeak, Comrade Grant, not your little endeavor. At this juncture, it is far more accurate to state our little endeavor. And that is the true punchline to my private joke. I give you permission to join in the laughter.
The Bykovo Airport lay some 20 miles southeast of central Moscow. According to Sverdlovsk, it was the only one of the four major airfields around Moscow that had survived the nuking marginally intact. The port itself had been rebuilt and repaired from concrete, duroplast, and vanadium alloy. Riding in the back of an open-top jeep, Grant and Cain noted a number of medium-sized prop aircraft and a pair of gargantuan personnel-carrying transports.
This is all we could salvage of our once majestic air force. As it is, keeping these few machines in operating order is an almost insurmountable task. They are, after all, over 200 years old.
Bridget, in the passenger seat, eyed the position of the sun. She guessed it was a few minutes shy of 10 o'clock, and the morning sky was cloudless and sunny, the thermometer 10 degrees higher than it had been 24 hours before. The previous evening, they had been driven, under guard, to a secluded safe house outside the city. They had been given separate rooms, and though they were comfortably appointed, the doors were locked and sentries posted. They didn't have the opportunity to talk among themselves, even over the transcoms, since Sverdlovsk saw to it that Bridget's unit was confiscated and Grant's and Kane's coats taken. At least all of them had enjoyed a fairly restful night, and they took advantage of the in-suite bathrooms to clean themselves. Sverdlovsk had suggested they do so, saying cryptically that it might be their last chance for quite some time. Then they had been served an early morning breakfast by the silent sentries, who stood by while they ate, making sure they didn't appropriate any of the cutlery. After they had finished, Sverdlovsk arrived, returned Grant's and Kane's coats, and announced it was time to begin their journey. He had jovially but steadfastly refused to answer any of the questions put to him, saying only they would learn everything in time. He braked the jeep to a halt before a huge metal-walled hangar. Four khaki-clad AKM-wielding troopers bracketed the open double doors. Sverdlovsk led the way inside the hangar. Inside was a gray transport plane, looking for all the world like a humpback whale outfitted with a pair of wings. Sverdlovsk affectionately patted the riveted metal skin of the craft.
This is a Tu-114 turboprop cargo and troop carrier. It was converted back in the 1980s to an early warning recon ship. They used to be known as Mossbacks.
Why?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Judging by the prideful smile on the Russian's face, he expected them to be impressed. And they were, though they tried hard not to show it. Because of the 250-mile-per-hour winds that once swept regularly over the rad-ravaged face of America, aerial travel had been very slow to make a comeback. Unpredictable geothermals in the hell zones and chemstorms quadrupled the hazards of flying. Even the Deathbirds, their manufacture dating back to the last decade of the 20th century, had only been pressed back into service 30 or so years ago. For all intents and purposes, winged aircraft were obsolete in the Deathlands of America, and though all three of them had seen pre-dark pics of the machines, they were overwhelmed by the power suggested by the sheer bulk and wingspan of the Tu-114. Small forklifts raised crates into the open cargo hatch in the plane's belly. The crates were all marked with the number 12. Several of them were long and flat, fitting the contours of the slabs of armaglass they had seen in the warehouse. Kane looked up at the cockpit, and through the port he saw Lenya Ivornich in the co-pilot's seat. She wore a headset and seemed engrossed in checking out the instrument panel systems. She suddenly looked up, caught his eye, and smiled at him warmly. Sverdlovsk went to the foot of the set of metal steps rolled up against the plane.
We're right on our departure schedule, so if you will board and find seats for yourselves, we'll get underway.
None of them moved.
We know where you want to take us. We don't know why.
The why is simple, comrade. You have no choice. Should I remind you that in your short time in Russia, you've impersonated official personnel, trespassed on restricted property, seriously wounded a security network officer, and killed another? The last charge alone warrants immediate execution.
Don't lean on us, Colonel. This venture is either a cooperative effort or it isn't.
And if it isn't?
Then you're wasting your time and resources hauling us to Mongolia. We won't identify a single artifact in Karakoto.
Yes, you're right. I shouldn't pressure you. The awareness that I am in a position to do so, if need be, is enough.
That's right. Return our property to us as a show of good faith. Then we'll show ours.
When we reach our destination. You have no need of weapons while we're airborne. Surely you cannot argue with that.
Kane made brief eye contact with his companions, then bounded up the stairs leading to the Tu-114's passenger compartment. The others followed him. It was strictly a no-frills utilitarian aircraft. The seats were hard and stiff-backed, not designed for anything approximating comfort. There were only six of them. Kane, Bridget, and Grant occupied the three seats nearest the cockpit door. The other three in the rear were taken by a trio of alert-eyed SEC officers. They buckled in, and the cargo door slammed shut from beneath. Sverdlovsk pulled the thick, rubber-sealed outer hatch closed and entered the cockpit. The gray behemoth lurched from the hangar and onto the paved airstrip. Bridget, seated next to Kane on the aisle, gripped the armrests of her chair tightly. Her knuckles stood out like ivory knobs.
Are you nervous, Baptiste?
What do you think? I've never flown before.
Nothing to it. A crate this size is a hell of a lot safer than a death bird.
What happens if we crash?
Don't worry. Depending on our altitude and airspeed, if the smash doesn't kill you instantly, the burning fuel will. Either way, it's quick.
The TU-114 taxied to the tarmac and accelerated down the runway. Then, with a bump that jarred all of them in their seats, the landing gear wheels left the ground and the whale-shaped craft nosed skyward. Sitting behind Bridget and Kane, Grant noted admiringly how the takeoff was remarkably smooth for such a cumbersome machine. Kane looked out the window, watching the Vyukovo airfield fall away below. Bridget kept her eyes squeezed shut.
Say dasvidaniya to the motherland, Baptiste.